Hi, I'm Steve Hadley, Chair of the Federation of Piling Specialists. Today, we're going to be learning more about one of our industry's most important materials, concrete. What goes into it, how it's made, and how it can form part of a low-carbon industry in the future. That's all coming up right after a message from our sponsor.
At Central Piling, we have a fleet of continuous flight auger, rotary board, and driven rigs of various sizes. This caters for most piling and retaining wall needs. Our team's technical, logistical, and operational strengths provide clients with a flexible and reliable design and build solution across England and Wales. We pride ourselves on understanding the environment within which we work and being a responsible contractor. To ensure greater efficiency and meet our growth targets, we are always developing our people, plant, and services. We now offer a plant and operator hire service, including ancillary equipment. For more details, please visit centralpiling.com or phone 01787 474 000. That's 01787 474 000.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Federation of Piling Specialists podcast. I'm joined today by Dr. Jim Branch from Hanson Concrete and Robin Stiles. Jim is a regional technical manager and Robin is technical development manager. How are you both?
Morning.
Great to see you. What I'd really like to do today is to explore some of the fundamentals of concrete, the constituent materials, the design processes involved, and move on to talk about QA and sustainability points, which of course are really in focus at the moment. I'd actually just like to start with Jim. Jim, been a friend of mine now for I think it's about 20 years, and probably my oldest friend within the industry, I think.
You're the only one left in it in the UK, yeah.
Yeah, and you know, I think it's worth touching on how, because it was a mutual friend or colleague of mine at the time, but friend now, Eddie, who you used to work with and study with, Eddie Whittam, who I know he's a listener of this podcast as well.
Morning, Ed.
Yeah, or afternoon, but depends when he's tuning in. Of course, he's working in Australia now, but you'd known him through.
We were at university together, and rather strangely, our logistics manager now was actually a friend of Ed's at the University of Hertfordshire as well. We realised we had Ed in common as a mutual friend fairly recently, so I knew said chap by his rugby team nickname, because Ed was heavily involved in the rugby. But didn't realise we actually knew each other until fairly recently. And Ed again was the it's a bit like the Kevin Bacon of the industry, possibly. Six steps removed from Eddie Whittam.
That could well be the case. But you got dragged in. So Eddie and I were at Rock and Alluvium at the time, and we're talking to you about, well, we wanted to learn a bit more about how concrete was being made and look at some of your quality processes as well. I do remember we had a visit to one of your plant yards.
We arranged, I think we arranged yourselves to come, and you and your team and your key team members to come to King's Cross, I believe it was, to look at the concrete plant, look at the limitations of what we can't do, but equally the benefits we could offer. Because at the time, I mean, in hindsight, it's quite, we were ahead of the game, Steve, or you were, with regards to trying to make your partnerships, if you like, within the industry, and how we could be more efficient and material savings, possibly cost savings then, but in hindsight would equally apply to the sustainability agenda, whereby we're where could we offer cement replacement, so on and so forth, and best solutions, thus reducing waste, cost and energy, etc. So the similar tenets, I would say, are applied now. So
I think it was, for me, it was more than anything, it was just interesting to see how it was all pulled together, and for anybody that's not had the opportunity that works in the piling industry, do speak to your material suppliers and try and arrange a visit, because it brings it all to life. You understand how the quality's put in there. You understand a bit more about the materials that are going in.
And I would say from our perspective, it's very good if we understand what our customer needs are. Now, if we speak to our customers, the better we understand what they actually need, and what we can do to offer them and benefit the process from the start. So
yeah,
I think it's very helpful.
Yeah. Okay. And then of course from there our bromance blossomed into something else. You know, with our sort of mutual interest in golf and music. You know, you're a ska DJ at the time, aren't you? And
you dabbled.
You got all sorts
one
of
could, one could say yeah. A friend had a bar at the time, and we used to do a Sunday night set. I think you were probably one of the only people there. It was good fun, but I would never say it was the most successful enterprise.
No.
But yeah, it was good. It was good. It was good while it lasted.
Well, maybe the Las Vegas residency will come up in the future. Who knows? Second career, maybe.
Indeed.
But you know, it's been a lot of fun, and I think what it shows is how important relationships, friendships, can be in your working lives, we shouldn't just fall back on, right, we've got personal lives and work life. The two can be quite intertwined, and it can put a lot more value and pleasure into those periods.
Absolutely.
So let's talk about some of the basics of concrete, shall we? So let me define it. I'll let you and Robin come in and start correcting me. So, to the layperson, concrete is cement, sand and gravel, water, and if you want to make it do something a little bit different, stick some sort of chemicals in there, some plasticizers and admixtures to change the way it performs. Have I got that basically right?
I would say so. I think Robin and I, our hearts were in our mouths when we heard cement, thought it might sort of end there. It's a bit of a bugbear of ours where cement and concrete get conflated.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, particularly for me, working with the cement.
Well, you do see people talking about cement lorries when they actually mean concrete, ready-mix trucks, don't you? But there's so many different types of cement. So let's talk first of all about Portland cement, which is, I don't know if that's the first type of cement. I mean, cement in some sort of format has presumably been around for centuries. I mean, the Colosseum's all stuck together somehow with presumably, is it lime-based cement?
Yeah, I mean, if you go back thousands of years. I mean, the Romans had a form of cement which was based on natural pozzolanas and lime. What we think of as modern Portland cement was, well, the original patents were in the early 19th century, around about 1824, I think. Don't quote me on that number. I might be a few years out either way.
I've written it down now, Robin. It's too late.
but that material is now what we think. It was the basis of the process of what we think of as modern Portland cement, which is a combination of limestone, sorts of carbonates and silicates that we blend together and grind and then heat in a kiln to produce a cement clinker.
Mm-hmm.
And that is more or less what we, when people talk about cement, that's generally what they think of. But in modern terms, a cement is a material that can be a combination of that Portland cement and other materials. It can be, for instance, fly ash or blast furnace slag, limestone, and various other products. And I think in the European standard now, there's well over 30 different types of cement. Mm. Classified,
all
with different combinations of what we think of as a Portland cement with different products. So when someone says cement now, it can mean a broad range of materials.
Okay.
Are we actually allowed to call it Portland cement anymore, Robin? Or is that...
Well, yeah. I mean, the technical definition is a SEM 1 to the European standards. But yeah, that's what we think of in the industry generically as a Portland cement.
Do you know why it's called Portland cement? I googled this earlier.
It's because it bears a resemblance to the Portland Stone down on the south coast. So they went, oh, it looks like Portland Stone, because that was what was used in the time, I believe, a lot for some of the major constructions in London. So the material had a similar colour to Portland Stone, so they called it Portland Cement. That's the reason.
Marketing.
Makes the world go round. So some of the other common ones, there's PFA, which is pulverised fuel ash, but again, probably under a new designation. I can't remember which.
Yeah, I mean, that would commonly come out, a blend of Portland cement and fly ash is commonly under the SEM, one of the SEM 2 designations, and under SEM 2. SEM 2, the different designations, so you've got SEM 1, which is the Portland cement, SEM 2, SEM 3, SEM 4, all in sort of Roman numerals, so you've got SEM II, SEM III, or SEM IV. They're all combinations of the cement with different proportions of different one of these materials. And the fly ash ones broadly fall under a SEM 2 designation.
Okay. But fly ash, so that has been produced as a result of burning...
Right, fly ash comes from... it's the ash from power stations, from the generation of electricity. They'll take a specific grade of coal, they pulverise it, it gets blown into the furnace at a very high temperature, about 2,000 degrees. Some of the ash that comes from that process is collected, the finer particles, and can be reactive and can be used in concrete as a partial substitution for Portland cement. It's what has been used for many, many years, quite successfully. I just highlight, though, one thing is that we don't burn a lot of coal in the UK anymore. Put a couple of numbers to that. In sort of 2012, about 50%, up to 50% of our electricity came from coal-fired sources. This year, up to June, I don't think more than 5% of our electricity came from coal-fired power stations. And indeed, sort of around March, April time, through a significant period of time, we weren't burning any coal at all. So there was, if we're not burning coal, then that presents a challenge with sources of ash, certainly locally in the UK.
It's a material as a concrete supplier we no longer actually stock. I suppose you have to be careful in terms of stepping on other companies' toes, but the surety of supply within the UK is very, very difficult to maintain, so therefore we tend not to use it at all. We used to use it a lot up until I'd say 5-10 years ago, because we use GGBS, we use cement, we use PFA, microsilica, various materials, but we didn't, and PFA has its own properties that were really beneficial, but we can't guarantee that we can actually keep a stock of it available.
So GGBS, that is a byproduct of the steel industry in a similar way to PFA being through energy generation. So again, it's that sort of residue as the steel's heated up and you get this sticky mass, which clearly is.
Just to give you a very potted explanation of GGBS, it comes from the manufacture of iron, from the iron ore, particularly the material that comes from that. GGBS stands for ground granulated blast furnace slag. And it's particularly from the iron blast furnace process. What you're doing is you're heating a mixture of iron ore, limestone and coke as the fuel to about 2,000 degrees. You get a reduction reaction, you get the liberation of molten iron and the impurities bonding with the limestone to form a material known as slag. So the iron then goes off for processing into steel and for industrial commercial purposes. The slag then gets processed, and that's what comes to us because we have GGBS manufacturing facilities, and we then turn that into a finished product that we send out to the concrete manufacturers, that we send out to Jim's concrete plants. Again, it's been known about for 150 years, the hydraulic properties have been documented. It's really taken off since the 1970s for economic and durability reasons. Now more and more people are looking at it because it's got a very low carbon footprint. To give you some numbers, Portland cement in the UK is somewhere mid-800s kilograms of embodied carbon per tonne. GGBS is about 79.
Okay.
So, you know, the order of, you know, 10 times lower in terms of carbon footprint because it's an industrial byproduct.
But because it's a byproduct rather than because there wasn't carbon emitted as part of the process of it being created. It's
Yeah, okay.
That's already been factored into the steel manufacture. So, yeah.
Sure.
And it also equally, it removes the material from the waste stream as well, because that, you know, the GGBS or the slag from the manufacture of iron would be a waste, and that would need to be disposed of and handled. We're actually able to take that and use it in a positive way, which takes it out of the waste stream, and therefore you haven't got to send it to landfill, for example. With regards to the GGBS, he said, so there's a very simplified process, but we do actually have to, you know, we've refined the process. Again, Robin would know better than I about this, but the process has been refined in that we know that the quenching, as the slag is sort of exits the process, it has to be quenched in a specific way to give the glassy structure that we need to enable it to then be ground up and used. So there is an element of quality control almost from the get go with regards to it. Where I spent a while looking at Libyan material, where it was never quenched. It was basically sort of, you know, exited the manufacturing process, left in massive great piles.
Mm.
And retrospectively, I tried to look at it as a cement replacement because they've got so much of it. Because it had never been quenched properly, the reactivity was minimal. So I found it surprisingly interesting.
Well, let's look at the performance of these different cements and the different blends, because it sounds like maybe some of those products you couldn't use in isolation, or could you? Could you use purely a GGBS to make concrete and not have any Portland cement in there? Would it work?
Yes.
You wouldn't want your house to be made out of it.
No, not necessarily. No, I think if you take the replacement materials as a whole, they're what refer to as pozzolans. So they've got pozzolanic properties, which means they will hydrate. They will develop a network of hydrates and become a concrete material. But they require the initial products of hydrates from the CEM1 to be formed to allow them to then sort of hydrate themselves and become sort of structurally sound. I'd say that's very, very Janet and John version of version.
We need a bit of that.
Yeah. Yeah. Without the products of the initial cement hydration, the cement replacements aren't necessarily of any real use. GGBS has a latent hydraulic property, whereas PFA wouldn't. So which is why you're able to use more GGBS than you are PFA in the replacement. Is that right, Robin? Am I?
Yeah, I think basically. I mean, if you go and look at the yard of one of our GGBS factories, the actual loading area for the raw material is just GGBS that's been down for 40 years and has hydrated over time, but it's such a slow process on its own that you need to have something in there to activate it to make it usable in a timescale that's realistic for construction.
Yeah.
I'm going to go on in a sec to talk about specific mixes for the piling industry, as we are the FPS podcast. But before we do that, there's just a couple of other property fundamentals I want to establish. So we've got aggregates, which is basically various different sizes of sand and cement that's supplied. Why would you have more sand or more larger aggregate? How does that change the concrete mix design?
Well, I think I hadn't invited one of my colleagues from the aggregate division, and they'd probably be very upset by the simplistic. But yeah, basically you're right. The aggregates, you know, we use coarse aggregates, which are either, you know, nominally 10 mil maximum aggregate size or 20 mil, and sand, albeit that's a very simplified version. And all of the aggregates we refer to concrete, again, possibly stepping ahead, as a sustainable material because concrete is deemed to be a local product. And so if you buy a concrete in London or you buy a concrete in Newcastle, the aggregates could be significantly different, which has a massive impact on the concrete and what we have to do to the concrete to make it a usable, functioning material. And we have to play with the proportion. We have to have a good understanding of the aggregates to actually be able to create the right balance for the application that the concrete's being prepared for. So the fines content dictates that the maximum aggregate size has to be appropriate for the end use, so on and so forth. So there's quite a lot.
It's not to be taken into account. As simple as saying put in more larger aggregate and less smaller fines and you'll have a stronger mix.
No, it's unfortunately not. Basically the concrete water cement ratio is the key to concrete strength. So that's the amount of water in there versus the amount of cement, which is why we have significant panics when we see water additions on site, because we put the water up, you compromise the durability and the strength of the concrete. That is, the water cement ratio is a function of specific surface area. So when you look at a cubic meter of concrete, all of the constituents have their own surface area. And when you look at the full cubic metre of concrete, there's a total specific surface area within that cubic metre of concrete. If you put more fine material in there, the specific surface area of the concrete goes up, and then that then requires more water to coat the specific surface area of all the materials. And then that then requires more cement to maintain the water-cement ratio of the product. So if you say, for example, broadly speaking, so if you've got a fines content of 40% of your aggregate fraction, 40% of it is fine material, you may have one cement content. If you then increase that for the application to 45-50%, which a lot of piling companies will do, the surface area within that cubic metre goes up. You'll also invariably have a water cement ratio criteria to meet because of the environment into which the concrete's being placed. So therefore, we have to meet that water cement ratio, and the cement content goes up to meet that. So it's a bit of a puzzle that we have to sort of deal with.
Yeah, difficult balance to strike, I'm sure. And I'll pick up on your point there, Jim, about the addition of water, which has been levelled at piling contractors in the past. the crews are adding water. Of course, the reason that they would have added water probably is to help with the installation of reinforcement cages or the duration that the loads of concrete can be kept on site. I think with the changes and the development of mixed designs over the recent past, I think that should really have become less of an issue, providing people are aware of what's out there. And they're buying the right stuff. So flow mixes, for instance, let's just talk about that. Flow mixes wasn't even really on my radar until a few years ago. And, the types of structures that the piling industry are building now tend to be bigger and bigger, which means more reinforcement, bigger piles, more challenging soil conditions sometimes. So you do have to be adaptable. Certainly what we've seen is the switch to a flow mix in an area that, for instance, we've got a dry sand, long reinforcement cage. That's meant that we've had less blockages, less problems getting reinforcement cages in, less quality issues. So that's been a really good shift. But for the listener's benefit, can you just explain the key difference between a flow mix and a slump mix?
It's interesting you say that. And this has been, the developments of the compositions and the solutions we're able to offer have been, the development of the appropriate chemicals to facilitate these things. When I started, when I was a boy, I'm finding myself saying this a lot at the moment, but when I first started on site, started as a technician 30 years ago, back then, a skip mix, as we called it, was a 50 mil slump. The pump mix was 75 mil slump, and a piling concrete was 125 mil slump. And they were basically the concretes that everyone used. In hindsight, you know, looking at them, I think the lack of chemicals that were in there actually made, you know, we used water as a, you know, as a fluidizing agent, if you like. And it was quite, you know, you could actually use those materials. If you turned up now with a 75 mil pump mix, I think you'd probably have a, you know, you'd have a revolution, you know, everyone would pack up and go home.
Yeah.
But the use of admixtures has allowed us to develop concretes that are fit for purpose and user friendly. Mm-hmm. So flowing concretes, as you touched on, they have to be well designed to enable them to stay together and be cohesive and be robust enough to take the performance requirements. And when they're in a pile, they need to not consolidate or not segregate. My old friend, the Rogier equation, which I love it when you're able to use something that you learnt at university or college or whatever in the real world. I remember your excitement when you finally used a quadratic equation in the wild, Steve. That was
absolutely, yeah. I wrote a little program for it, which made me even more delighted. I had it on my calculator, which was probably the size of an iPad. I was delighted with that. But yeah, carry on. We don't
Rogier.
Yeah.
There's fixed points in there. You've got the rho being the density of the material, g being gravity, and then h being the head of pressure. And H varies, obviously. So when you've got a pile of differing heights or depths, then the hydrostatic head being applied to the materials within that will vary. And therefore, the way the material behaves within that environment will vary. When we talk about segregation, it's that mechanism that's driving the segregation. So all of the heavy materials want to drop to the bottom and the light materials come to the surface.
Okay.
And under pressure. So we need to come up with a composition that actually enables that material to stay as a solution, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
Monolithic. Like when you're doing plunge piles, for example, or in your industry, when you're casting plunge piles, you can't have any bleed in the pile. Whereas most, you know, if I don't know if it's the norm now, but breaking back used to be the typical. Yeah, you'd sacrifice 2 meters or whatever it was of the depth of the pile to break back to get to the solid concrete, because you knew there was a degree of material at the top that wasn't necessarily as good as it could be.
Yeah, we talk about latent material sort of rising to the top. So we typically talk about 300 to 500 mil of concrete that needs to be trimmed back.
Mm.
Which usually has to be the case anyway, because you've got to leave the reinforcement down and then you've got to get the connection. So it sort of works. It generally works okay anyway, just trimming it back. But are you saying that actually nowadays there probably doesn't need to be as much trimmed off to get to good concrete as there used to be?
I'd like to think so. You know, I'd like to think so on the whole. I personally speaking, I don't like drilling holes in my wall, right? Because I don't know what I'm going to hit. So anyone who piles has my undying respect. You know, especially when you look at some of the D walls and CFA piles, we don't necessarily know what's down there. So I'd like to say, you know, it's segregation and bleed and all that are a thing of the past. But obviously, the ground conditions have a huge impact on the final product.
Of course,
but we now have a much better understanding of looking at where issues have arisen with things like static segregation, which is where, you know, the concrete in the pile actually just falls apart.
Yeah,
you know, how do we stop that happening? How can we sort of help with that process?
Mm.
And there's various tests, etc., that can predict when it may or may not occur. And flowing concretes are almost a product of that. Understanding, and I think the industry has a better is more confident with the materials. I think when you first considered them, Steve, you probably looked at them and thought, that's, you know, whether your confidence levels with regards to how wet the concrete appears you know, were you concerned at all that it may not be? Yeah.
Yeah, I thought, is this ever going to go off?
Yeah.
But you find out quickly enough, and obviously that it passes. There is, of course, there is a commercial concern because it's more expensive, as you were talking about earlier about water cement ratios and so on. With those sort of mixes, there'll be more cement, and it's the cement that's the really expensive bit. And so you are going to be paying a premium for that. I think there's no two ways about it. But there are benefits in terms of safety from doing that and quality assurance.
And I think the point of water addition, if you're starting with a wetter material, that you can place an S4 or a 150mm slump concrete. If you started with a flowing concrete, something's gone wrong on site and that concrete's come back to a 150 slump, you can place it anyway. Mm-hmm. You don't then, there wouldn't be a temptation to add water to the concrete to facilitate and overcome an issue that you've encountered when the concrete was delivered as like 2 hours prior.
Yeah.
Equally, we can, the standard implies there's a 2 hour window from the production of concrete to the placement. With flowing concretes and retarders, etc., we can, that becomes a bit of a moot point.
Yeah.
We know the concrete will stay open for 3 hours, 4 hours. Some people will specify an open life to overcome issues on site, and therefore, the 2 hour window from batching to placement stops being an issue.
Yeah.
I think it makes life easier, as you say, sort of safety wise as well. If you're not having to, I'm always concerned with the safety of the product we produce, that it is quite it will burn people chemically, and it's hard work to move if it's heavy, if it's not mobile. The fact that we can produce a flowing concrete that's easy to handle, easy to place, won't cause issues. You then haven't got people coming into contact with that material. And I think the final product is just generally better, and you haven't got the concerns over quality you may have had previously.
Yeah, it's come a long way. So in terms of secant wall piling and soft pile mixes, that's also developed, because I think there was an extreme nervousness for piling contractors like us when you would take on a secant wall job and always concerned about, well, what age should I start drilling the concrete, the soft piles? What day should I start drilling the hard piles? Will I be able to get in? Will the piles be straight? How have the mixed designs developed over the last few years in that regard?
Well, I've said it's an interesting subject. Deep pile foundations, piling, etc. The processes that you use, I would say, have developed significantly over the last decade or so. Soft pile, I remember seeing a soft pile inquiry for the first time. It doesn't seem that long ago. It may have been around for years and I just never came across it, but it doesn't seem that long ago. And I remember having to go to site to try and sort of, we'd get a call to say these piles are out of alignment. And we didn't necessarily understand what we were doing that was influencing this sort of the piles to kick out. Remember one particular incident where the piles had actually encroached into the space where the basement was going to be.
Yeah, and always a big concern.
Park. Yeah, indeed. And there was the car park, with the skin wall they would have to put on it would actually stop access to the car park under a building in Pimlico, it was. And how on earth one can overcome that. And I stood there like, But obviously, we now know that if the soft pile goes off too quickly, then it throws the hard pile out of alignment.
Yeah.
Yet, if the soft pile doesn't go off quickly enough, it can crumble and won't allow the hard pile to bite into it. So therefore, there's has to be just right, a bit like Cinderella or Goldilocks, has to be just right. Yeah. And that comes from dialogue with the end user, what their program is, how they want the concrete to behave, and the end user has to have an understanding that the results we may have will be under a set of circumstances which may not be replicable within what they're trying to achieve, and the ground conditions will have an impact. So you know, we are able to play with the blend levels, play with the strength gain to try and give as much performance as possible. But I'd say it has to be site specific. You can't just simply say we want a soft pile material and expect a generic soft pile material to behave and perform exactly the same in every circumstance. So yeah, we have a better understanding of what you're looking for, and hopefully you know, yourselves, you'll be speaking to us to try and achieve what you want to with it.
You've been looking at the Tremi mixes as well for.
Yeah.
I think there's the Tremi guide from the EFFC, the European Federation of Foundation Contractors, which the Federation of Partner Specialists is associated with. How's that changed the approach? I'm afraid I've personally not been involved with any of those projects, but have you got an awareness of that?
It's interesting. I think the guide we tend to use here seems to have come from Australia, I believe. Learning points from Australia. There's a global. You know, this is a global industry. I think we have to be open to what's going on in other parts of the world and learning points from other countries. In fact, we see quite a lot of American standards quoted these days. But so basically, there was an issue whereby deep pile foundations, whether they be sea camp or wet piles or diaphragm walls or whatever they may be, that they were exhibiting issues in situ. When I first got involved with it, the term being used was static segregation. So you would cast a very deep pile and then that pile would then fall apart. So it would, for whatever reason. Okay. And what was causing that and how could one predict if that was going to happen? Diaphragm wall processes are very expensive and if they go wrong are very, very expensive to remediate. So almost you have one opportunity to get it right, and you know, so no one wants it to go wrong, including us. The EFFC document basically lists a series of tests that the concrete should be subjected to and the parameters within which it should fall that should provide the best outcome.
Mm.
If the concrete meets all these criteria, then therefore it should perform in situ. And that's been beneficial because it codifies a lot of the things that we would have, you know, we would have been suggesting.
Okay, because you talked to me in the past, Jim, and I know you spend a lot of your weekends when you're not golfing looking at trial mixes.
Indeed, yeah.
in the lab working out what's going to be most suitable. How important do you think that is?
Oh, hugely. So with especially the large infrastructure projects, it's massively important and very, very hard to. You know, there's a lot of hard work goes into a lot of these solutions we offer, but you don't necessarily know until you put it through a concrete plant and put it through the process if it's going to actually work. Concrete is. We do our very best to predict it, but I'm always at great pains when we do the training sessions with our staff. You know, you're taking two types of cement, you're taking possibly three aggregate fractions, water and a chemical to create a repeatable product. Whereas the materials we're using and combining are all subject to their own standards and their own variabilities and whatnot. So they can change and the performance of the final product can change, and we have to try and be able to predict that and understand that, and water demand being the key driver. When we see a change in water demand when we're producing concrete, usually indicates there's been a change within the constituent materials. But yeah, the testing to the EFFC document will give a huge amount of comfort that the materials we're producing are suitable for the application. However, it does sometimes bleed into where someone who's doing a CFA pile will be told they need to comply with this document, which will involve L-box tests, tests that aren't typically carried out, bowel filtration tests, L-box tests, static segregation tests, various other criteria. And if the concrete that is purchased to meet all of the test criteria, it will be very different to a standard CFA piling concrete.
Mm.
mm-hmm. And isn't necessary. So you're pushed into a situation where you're having to purchase some material that meets a set of test criteria that aren't necessarily applicable to the scenario in which you want to use the concrete. And so I think there needs to be an understanding of when the various tests and documents are applied and when they're appropriate, when they're not. Because otherwise it could be very, very cost inefficient and not sustainably the best solution either.
Yeah, because as much as this is a science, you mentioned there that there's so many variables involved that empirical testing and analysis, it's really crucial to see how it's actually going to perform in reality.
As my beloved late cousin Michael always used to say to me when I'd meet him, how are the black arts going, Jim? Because it's and in fact, you know, this is what we joke, but the, you know, some of the academic papers you read, some of the academic publications do, you know, they don't stop short from referring to some of the behaviours being all akin to a black art, and you know, the term, the mechanisms behind this are not fully understood.
No.
You know, and sort of there's a lot of that going. So yeah, as you say, there's a lot of empirical data that goes into the and predicting best behaviours that goes into it. So and a degree of unicorn dust and
yeah. Well, wise words there from Michael. Bless him.
Yeah, God rest him.
So we've spoken there about doing some testing on potential mixes, and that forms part of quality assurance. What are the QA procedures are there out there? There's QSRMC is reasonably well recognised within the industry. How does that differ from something like your ISO 9001 quality assurance?
It is 9001, the QSRMC certificate, or QSRMC audit us to 9001. So they are an accreditation body for that standard. So when there was a company called RMC, and we were assessed by a company called Quality Scheme for Ready Mix Concrete, and the company was called Ready Mix Concrete, it sounded slightly incestuous, but they have always been an independent body, and they're accredited and by the British standards to carry out the audits.
So is there a legal requirement to have that as a ready mix supplier or not?
No, you can supply concrete without being third party accredited. However, and I'd say slightly concerned, some, I don't have to be careful, but some of the ready mix suppliers that are out there, the smaller businesses, they will be supplying materials that are what are called designated concretes under the British standard, but you're not actually allowed to supply those unless you are third party accredited. So RC concretes, you know, some of the RC 40, 3240, for example, FND concretes, things like that, you have to have a third party accreditation within the standard to actually be able to put that on the delivery ticket. So yes, there are some limitations to not having a third party accreditation to 9001. Mm-hmm. However, you don't need to have it.
Okay. But all the major suppliers, yes, and we're not going to name them all now, but all the major ones, they would have the QSRMC.
Some are actually accredited directly by BSI. So they have just BSI accreditation rather than QSRMC accreditation. And I think the BSI body, Robin, you may correct me if I'm wrong here, but the BSI audits differ to the QSRMC audits, albeit the outcome's the same.
Yeah, they approach things in a slightly different way to QSRMC. QSRMC being more of a sector specific scheme, mm-hmm, rather than BSI, who look at auditing on they'll look at a number of ISO 9000 schemes throughout different industry sectors. No, so not, they're not just focused on ready mix concrete, whereas QSRMC are, as I say, sector specific. They are, their background is, their experience is ready mix concrete. So they're purely focused on that, and they are giving, they have a deep understanding of concrete. So they will be able to look at the auditing from that point of view and understand the critical success factors in making a concrete.
Okay.
And equally, they QSRMC will audit our customer base as well. On
interesting.
Some of our customers are QSRMC. Their 9001 is provided by QSRMC. So as an auditor, they can, you know, they look at the whole industry, which I think is really helpful. And there's a, we're working in various different working groups. I've suggested a couple of times that the QSRMC, I've sent an invite to QSRMC to join, because obviously if they're looking at our customer base and the way the customer base is specifying our product, and they're looking at the way we meet those specifications, I think they're in the best position to have an oversight of the whole process. So they're very good, very helpful as well.
So they come out, they check your design, they check your plants are doing it in the right way, they go through the entire process.
So they'll go through from, if you like, you know, from when we get an inquiry through to what we actually produce and supply to the customer, to ensure that the inquiry is being met. Mm-hmm. And at every stage we are sort of doing what we should be doing to ensure that our delivery ticket at the end, because all of our delivery tickets, every declaration on our delivery tickets to the customer has to be assessed to make sure that we are actually meeting those declarations. So it's that, and then does that meet what was actually asked for in the first place?
Yeah.
So it's a complete, they do separate audits on our, you know, sales office, for example, our technical records audits. So my team were audited by QSRMC independent of the other departments.
Yeah.
The production team are audited separately. So each of our plants is subject to an audit.
Mm-hmm.
Every step of the process is audited by QSRMC. And each and every plant that we operate has their own independent QSRMC audit.
Okay.
So it's very, very involved.
And where does a group like the Concrete Society fit into that picture? is the Concrete Society more like, I don't know, the Federation of Piling Specialists, I suppose?
Yeah. Well, they're not, I wouldn't say, I don't know if they're a lobby group. I know, Robin, you may be able to step in. We've got the MPA, who are the Mineral Products Association. We've got the, is it QPA, Quarry Products Association?
Yeah.
Or is it all one now? I can never remember.
They've all merged in the same banner. Yeah.
And then you've got the Concrete Society. You've got This Is Concrete. You've got the Institute for Concrete Technology. You've got the BRMCA, which is the Bureau for Ready Mix Concrete, or something?
I believe it's British Ready Mix Concrete Manufacturers Association, along those lines.
And we used to have this, and we've got C&CA, which is the Cement and Cement Admixture Association. So there's an awful lot of various different groups and bodies.
Okay, it sounds like we could get lost. Quite a conversation that. But talking of concrete names, my favourite one that you've mentioned in the past is the William the Concreter.
That's a supplier.
We shouldn't give him too much publicity, but it does amuse me.
Yeah. there was another very good name on the market, which has obviously now been sullied and withdrawn, but there are a few. Yeah,
I think. Anybody wanting to know the answer to that can email it.
Yeah. Straw veil over that one. Yeah.
It's now in poor taste. Yes.
Yes. Okay.
But yeah, all those bodies are very helpful, and we've got the Green Construction Council or the all these various different groups, and they're all incredibly helpful in their own way. Mm-hmm. Some of them are marketing, some of them, the Institute of Concrete Technology is, as it implies, is very much, I speak to them quite regularly. If I get any query about reading a specification or how to meet a specification so on and so forth, they're very helpful in that regard, and I'll refer customers to them as well. And they can come out and they can act as a mediator sometimes as well. If there's a problem on site, a member, because our customers are members as well, can call them out and they'll do an independent report as to sort of what the problem is, where the problem occurred, how it can be remediated. So they're sort of almost a referee sometimes as well. So there's a yeah, and they, they they help with training, those various different training modules offered in conjunction with the Derby University or University of Derby or whatever it's called. And they, you know, they make those sort of industry wide, and they offer their own training as well. So they're very useful. And I think most of the others, without denigrating them, are, you know, the marketing or lobby. I don't know, are they lobby groups, Robin, would you say? Or
I mean, from the point of view, I have to confess that I'm vice chairman of one of the regions of the Concrete Society. So, we view it as an organisation for promoting awareness and, you know, providing training and support. Yeah, we do regular seminars on various topics around concrete and cement and, you know, the materials that go into concrete to provide, you know, education and training across the board within the industry.
And sustainability is of huge interest to us. And the Roadmap to Zero, for example, is run by, you know, MPA Concrete Society. They draw all of the different stakeholders together to discuss industry-wide concerns.
Yeah, I mean, let's pick up on that, because to what extent do you think the concrete industry has had cause to reflect and be introspective about its own impact on climate change? Because the figures are pretty stark. Maybe it doesn't make you feel great about being part of the industry. Or on the other hand, and this is the way I like to look at it, actually, I've got a great opportunity for making positive change.
Indeed. I think that's important. And, you know, we don't want to waste our opportunities. I think we do need to bear in mind, you know, with concrete, the benefits it brings. Yes, I'll allow Robin to talk more about the sustainable nature of cement. As a material, there's a very good podcast, the 50 Things That Changed the Modern Economy. One of them focuses on concrete and ready-mix concrete, and it talks about in Mexico how each family was given a proportion of ready-mix concrete to cast a floor, and the huge impact and benefits that had to society. And I think we can overlook the general benefits in terms of what is achievable using concrete. You know, if it didn't exist, what would we do, type thing? And if it's managed properly, it is quite a sustainable product. Although it sounds counterintuitive.
Well, that's the problem, though, isn't it? In the past, it's not been managed properly, and we've used too many products that have produced too much carbon. But the great thing is now there is that conversation about how we can reduce the carbon emissions related to it.
The catalyst in my world was the Olympics. The Olympics was predicated, the construction of the Olympic Park was predicated almost entirely on making the most sustainable solution possible for that development. And the requirements changed as the project developed. And, you know, in that we used all sorts of materials there, you know, sort of they had glass sand as a replacement for virgin sand. We used an awful lot of secondary aggregates. In using the sand, we were using an awful lot of PFA to offset the silica, you know, make sure there was no negative impact from the silica and things like that. So it was quite a lot of innovation there. And that drove the sustainability agenda, I would say, within the industry, or at least within my part of the industry, the area I operate. And in the short term after that, we saw a huge, you know, interest in sustainability. But I think the sustainability, it may not be as apparent possibly at times, but every industry, you know, your industry is having has their own forum with regards to how to make your industry more sustainable. We've got our own forums and working groups that, you know, I'm in a couple of them, and partnering with a few universities about how we can make the material as sustainable as possible, you know, from in terms of the constituent materials and the processes, through to how do we mitigate waste, how do we get it right first time. You know, the waste, you know, if you have to do it twice, you've generated twice the carbon. So how can one reduce the waste generated by you know, get it right first time type approach to things.
But they are,
and all of that goes back to Robin. He's the man ultimately, and he's going to save the world. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I suppose, as from the cement point of view, you know, you're always going to look at us as the source of, when we talk about sustainability and carbon, is where does the carbon come from, the embodied carbon come from in the concrete? And the answer is, broadly, a lot of it comes from the cement and the cement materials that we use in there. This is, you know, this is something that you know, has been the case for a long time. And, you know, it's important to bear in mind that we are already doing things to mitigate, you know, the environmental impact of concrete. You know, we use an awful lot of GGBS in concrete, and particularly in piling mixes, you can be replacing up to 70% of the cement with a material like GGBS, which is having a huge impact on the carbon footprint of that concrete. I mean, typically for a 70% replacement mix, compared to a baseline traditional Portland cement concrete, you're talking of the order of 60% lower in carbon footprint.
Yeah, that's where you've got to understand this, what you're trying to do with the product, isn't it? And I think sometimes we just get blinded by thinking, well, it's got to reach 35 newtons at 28 days and that's it, and it's no good otherwise, you know, for our basic design requirements. But actually, if you think about a house or a block of flats, at what point is the piled foundation going to be subjected to the maximum load? Well, it might be a year off if it's a block of flats. And therefore, is it reasonable to say we should be looking at 28-day strengths? Maybe we should look at 56-day or even longer strength gains, which presumably these replacement mixes, they've got a slower strength going, haven't they?
Yeah, I mean, this is sometimes, you know, where resistance can come from in the industry, that people, you know, look at the 1, 2, 3 day strength and think, well, this material's going to be a lower overall performance. But you're right, when we talk about high replacement levels, we might look at 56 days. Indeed, we've got a lot of, you know, information, and we know that the hydration with a GGBS in a high blend level will carry on. You know, if you look at the strengths at 90 and 180 days, you're seeing another 10 or 15% on the ultimate strength. Now, if that's, you know, if we know that and we can build that into our structure, we can then think about optimizing our mixes to use these high replacement levels. You know, I mean, I know there's been work, Jim, that you've done in your area looking at 80 and 90% replacement in certain applications, not necessarily for, you know, in general concrete, but There's a lot of work showing that we can, you know, look at areas where we can push these, you know, replacement materials.
And I think piling's the key. Yeah. You know, what possibly one of the best scenarios to be able to do it. Piling high volume elements, you know, very large elements, things like that. Mm. You know, really lend themselves to maximising cement replacements.
So what have we got coming up? What sort of new products in terms of cement or maybe recycled aggregates? What can we expect to see from the concrete and cement industries over the next, let's say, 10 or 20 years?
Well, I mean, I'll pick up the baton on cement on that one. I mean, as Heidelberg Cement internally, we have a target. We're looking to reduce carbon footprint. The number is 19% over current levels across Heidelberg Cement globally. You know, I know I talked right back at the start of this presentation about CEM1 in terms of its carbon footprint. We don't just make CEM1 cement in the UK, we make other types. We make CEM2 cements, blended cements. So our overall carbon footprint's about 590 kgs per tonne for all our cements we produce in the UK.
Okay.
Certainly broader than that. We're looking to get that down to about 500 in the next 10 years. The overall target for 2050 is aiming towards a carbon neutral concrete.
Is that realistic?
You know, it's a challenging goal. There are technologies, the new technologies are going to have to be developed to meet those targets. Work is underway with them. One of the first things we'll be looking at, and one of the things that's been underway for a number of years, is looking at more particularly the cement types we produce at the cement works, things like SEM2s instead of SEM1, and combining them with cement replacements in what we call ternary cements. There's a lot of work being done. The results that we're getting so far are very, very encouraging. We can make a very high performance cement with a lower level of clinker in it that can potentially be blended with a cement replacement to produce an even lower carbon footprint in the concrete. There are some regulatory challenges at the moment, but they're being worked on as we speak, to get to the point where we can look at getting these materials in. I think the vision is to move away from SEM1s being supplied in the future, where SEM1 becomes a specialist material for particular applications rather than a general material that gets supplied from our works.
Okay, yeah. That'd be good.
Yeah, much along the lines of, say, a rapid hardening cement, it becomes a niche product. Yeah, we will be looking towards producing these SEM2 type materials.
I think it's important as well, I would say, Robin, that we understand the baseline where, you know, that we're looking at. When we talk about concrete and cement replacements, the MPA sort of sets out that 20% replacement should be the norm, or is deemed the norm. So when you're seeing concrete, you know, eco concretes, the baseline that they're assessed against shouldn't be SEM1 in the first place. It should be sort of SEM1 with 20% replaced with AN, other cement replacement. What worries me slightly is you can get much better numbers if you say we're using a SEM1, you know, taking a SEM1 as your baseline and then replacing that, because, you know, that isn't the start of the, you know, the calculation should start with 20% replacement.
Yeah, and it's not just the type of cement as well, because you could, I don't know, let's take a slab design for instance, or a beam design. You put more reinforcement in, you don't need it to be as deep or as thick, which then complicates the design process further. And it's not a simple question or answer now, because there's so many different scenarios, but potentially we need to be looking at other products.
Yeah, I suppose there's a balance between the steel. I mean, I don't know what the steel CO, I should know what steel CO2 is, but I don't. But the balance between CO2 that's contributed by the steel in there versus the concrete, you know, there's always robbing Peter to pay Paul to an extent.
Yeah, I mean, then you've got, I remember back to my university days, so I was at uni in the 90s, and there was talk of fibres that you'd insert in concrete. Yeah. That seems to have gone, I certainly have not seen it used in any piling products. Is that something that you guys see as being part of the solution to this problem?
The fibres are sold on the basis of speeding up the production of concrete elements. There are certain applications in which they're inherent. You know, we're producing tunnel linings, for example, which have steel fibre reinforcement in there, and no in-situ reinforcement. The precast segments have a lot of reinforcement. Ground bearing. Why anyone would cast a ground bearing slab with reinforcement? Steel reinforcement in there, I'm not sure. You know, you can buy concrete with fibres, half plastic fibres, steel fibres, whatever they may be, which actually give you the structural reinforcement you need. Mm-hmm. And it's a one-stage process, so it's a lot quicker.
Okay.
It's just a much quicker process, I would suspect.
Do you see it being used, or is it again one of those examples where there's a lack of education from specifiers and from users, and they're not asking for the product?
The floor layer, there's specialist floor layers in that we've got specialist foundation companies and industries. There's specialist floor laying companies, and they tend to, you know, they understand it, and they will use fibres more so than a general contractor.
Okay.
So yes, though the section of the industry that knows about it or has to understand it are aware of it. Whether it's used as much as it could be, I don't know. And I actually asked recently about embodied CO2, whether or not, you know, the fibres actually benefit that, and there wasn't a massive amount of information available on that subject, and some of the fibre suppliers have gone away to try and look at it and come back with an answer as to whether there is a sustainability benefit for the use of the fibres over in situ reinforcement.
Okay. What about with the aggregate and the recycled materials? I don't know, what percentage of the aggregate that you use now would come from recycled sources? And do you see that as changing much over the next few years?
It's a very good question. and one actually, it's a debate I was having last week with colleagues for an upcoming project about the use of secondary aggregates. The aggregates are obviously a very large percentage of the concrete we or within the concrete we produce, and we use, touched on it earlier, you know, we have used glass, green glass crushed up as a sand replacement. However, you know, you have to be sure that the silica content of that concrete isn't going to cause things like alkali silica reaction, so it's a fine balance there, and it's not something I'd recommend I wouldn't recommend it without fully understanding it. But there are materials such as stent aggregate, it's known as China clay waste, that we use regularly, which is a secondary aggregate, not a recycled aggregate. And that material is diverted from the waste stream. It's one of the materials specified under the in BREEAM, the Building Research Establishment Environmental Assessment Method.
Yep.
And it's referred to in there as a suitable replacement for virgin aggregates, and it specifies, I believe, 25% replacement of the coarse aggregate fraction, and we can use that without any deleterious effects on the concrete or necessarily any impact on the cement contents, etc.
Yeah.
But the key point to understand with aggregates is that they don't necessarily impact on the overall CO2 content per cubic meter of concrete, because the transport's still there, which is a large part of the aggregate component of CO2. The transport's still present. Most of the materials will require a degree of processing, in the same way as virgin aggregates require processing. So what you're doing with aggregates is not necessarily reducing your CO2, but you are removing material from the waste stream, which is obviously beneficial in terms of the environment, and reducing the amount of virgin material required to produce a cubic metre of concrete.
Yeah.
I think it's eco points more than CO2 where the benefit is for that. Recycled concrete, I'll allow Robin to expand on that, but we're looking at recarbonisation of materials. But when you're in the
intriguing.
Wild and it is actually. When you're in the wild and you're looking at a source of aggregates for concrete, and you talk about recycled concrete, the source from which you get that aggregate has to be maintained. So if you're putting down a structure, you can then use that aggregate, and you can test that aggregate to ensure that the standards allow you the use of it, but they don't specify the tests one has to carry out. It has to be self-specified to ensure that there's nothing in the aggregates that would cause issues with the concrete long term. And then you end up in a conversation with who specifies what those tests should be. And equally, you have to have the surety of supply of the aggregate from a source. And if that changes, what do you then need to consider? So it's quite complicated to do. Where it has been used successfully is in airports, for example. Hard standings can be, they'll be ripped up. The aggregate's transported to a local concrete plant, replenished with fresh cement, and sent back out as cement bound materials for sub bases where they're actually having a structural impact as well as just being a capping material. So that's one application I've seen it used. We did the WWF or WWE, whichever it isn't the wrestling one, structure down in Woking, where we used recycled aggregates in that. And that won a Concrete Society Award, actually, and was attributed to the wrong concrete supplier, which still galls me slightly, because we've got an awful lot of work into that. And one of our competitors is all where their banner comes up as being responsible for
You've got to let it go, mate.
Oh, I know, I've got to let it go. But it's an interesting subject, but it's sort of slightly off-brand if we're talking CO2.
Okay.
But I'll let Robin, do you want to sort of outline the recarbonisation?
I mean, this is an interesting point, and you raised the point about the challenges around particularly recycled concrete and recycled aggregates in concrete. One of the technologies that we're looking at, and this is a Heidelberg cement scale, is taking demolition waste in the form of concrete from sites, processing that material, and then using a proportion of that, particularly the fine materials, as a raw material in the cement manufacturing process. As part of that, they'll look to recarbonate it, and it becomes part of the feed. That material has beneficial properties when you use it in the cement, and that's looking at a feed into the cement manufacture process. So we're taking the material, we're capturing carbon in it, and we're adding it to the cement to reduce the carbon footprint of the cement. And that's one of the technologies that we're looking at, again, to bring us towards this zero carbon footprint concrete by 2050. Again, it's at research and development stage, but the early signs of that are very, very encouraging. And that would be creating a higher value material out of the recycled material rather than just sticking it back in the ground as a fill, or potentially putting it in concrete and, again, increasing the CO2 impact by maybe having to increase your cementitious fraction in the concrete. So, yeah, that's a really, really interesting development that we're doing. And again, it's about taking the whole life cycle and you know, bringing the material back from site, back to the point of manufacture and reprocessing it.
I think the whole life cycle analysis you sort of touched on there, I think that's the key to understanding the benefits of our materials and how it should be understood within the context of sustainability. You know, life cycle analysis, you know, when you look at the length of time and the durability of the structures that are produced using concrete and cement. You know, you're talking design lives of 50 years, 100 years. So therefore, those structures shouldn't. You know, the CO2 within the concrete itself can be quite high impact.
Yeah.
However, once you assess it over a 50-year design life, and the properties that the concrete actually gives that structure, when you take that over its design life, that CO2 actually reduces significantly.
Thermal benefits, and buildings and concrete, right? So they can actually absorb carbon as well, can't they?
Yeah.
I don't know exactly the mechanism by which it absorbs carbon.
I think that's an entire topic that we could spend, a good chunk of time talking about. But yes, concrete can absorb some of the CO2 that's emitted in its manufacturing. I think see numbers around about 10%, 15% could be reasonable value to take on board.
It's quite interesting. It's one of the, because within the, you know, the was it 2050 or 2030 we're trying to get to net zero, and it's one of the I'd never considered it before, but it's one of the, you know, it's one of the tenets of, you know, achieving that is the, you know, the absorption of CO2 by concrete, and you know, the fact that it does actually offset itself over time. Although I don't know, I haven't got enough detail to actually put my mortgage on how wonderful the benefit is, but I know that it does exist. So but there's also, I mean, there's developments where we've got cements that absorb CO2 more. Is it Timo? Is it Robin?
Turner,
specialist cements that actually do absorb CO2 more so than others.
You might be thinking of the TOSEM, the titanium dioxide. Yeah. That's a slightly different mechanism, and that's something that we're looking at for nitrogen oxide reduction in urban environments, and particularly reducing NOx compounds that the potential for hazardous to human health. Big problem with infrastructure at the moment, and the car exhaust that produce a lot of these nitrogen oxides. We think we've just about finished the first job in London where we're using this material with these photocatalytic properties, which is what breaks down these nitrogen oxides. So yeah, we're working on pollution in other ways and not just CO2 footprint.
Well, it's a complex topic, and I think this conversation has been really insightful for me, and I'm sure for our listeners as well. And when it comes to addressing climate change, understanding and education is key. So thank you, Jim and Robin, so much for your contribution today. And
we'll come back. We'll talk about specifically durability of underground structures and aggressive climate environments and things like that at a later date, and the impact that has.
That'd be fun.
Part two.
I hope you enjoyed listening to today's podcast just as much as I enjoyed recording it. Don't forget to subscribe and also get in touch with any comments or questions that you might have. I've already had some fantastic suggestions for guests for next year, so please keep those coming too. Thank you.